If you've been waiting for more of Tony Soprano's universe, you're in luck.
The Many Saints of Newark isn't a sequel, but a prequel to The Sopranos, one that examines how the man we knew on television as mafia boss Tony Soprano was made from the kid and then the teenager we see here. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Linda Holmes. And today we're talking about The Many Saints of Newark on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Glenn is our very own Aisha Harris. Hey, Aisha.
Hello.
And also with us is Alan Sepinwall. He's Rolling Stone's chief television critic, host of the podcast Too Long Didn't Watch, and the author of the book, oh, wait, what is it called? Oh, The Sopranos Sessions. What expertise. Welcome, Alan.
Is The Sopranos, is this a good show? Should I watch this?
Well, you know, you may have heard of it. As I mentioned, this is a prequel, this film, to the series that was created by David Chase. Chase wrote the film with a Sopranos writer named Lawrence Connor, and it was directed by Alan Taylor, who's worked on a bunch of things, including Game of Thrones. So this is very much an HBO prestige TV type of team, even though it's a theatrical film as well as one that's streaming on HBO Max. The main character, though, you should know, is not Tony Soprano. It's his uncle Dickie, Christopher Moltisanti's father, played by Alessandro Nivola. This story takes place in two time periods. One's in 1967, one's in 1971. Characters that you know, if you watch the show, are played in younger iterations by actors you might also know. Vera Farmiga plays Livia, Tony's mom, and Corey Stoll plays Tony's uncle, Junior, who, by the way, is canonically bald, meaning Corey Stoll does not have to wear some sort of strange hairpiece, as he sometimes has in the past. Leslie Odom Jr. shows up as Harold, a black associate of Dickie's who has his eye on a future of his own. And young Tony Soprano, in his teenage years, is played by Michael Gandolfini, who is, as you might guess, the late James Gandolfini's son. We did have an episode yesterday about The Sopranos, the series, but we are moving on here to talk about the film. Aisha, what did you think about the movie?
Well, the tagline for this movie is "Who made Tony Soprano?" which is a question that I thought we'd already sort of answered through all of those therapy sessions that he had with Dr. Melfi throughout the series. So it wasn't a question I was particularly interested in. I had a lot of questions when I walked away from this movie. The first is, why is Christopher Moltisanti narrating this film from the grave? It's weird. It's never really fully connected to the story in any meaningful way. Another question I had was, why does Dickie Moltisanti want to, you know, carry out these good deeds? He keeps mentioning and going back and talking about how he wants to do these good deeds, one of which includes coaching a blind baseball team. I was very confused. I think the only reason that that scene existed was so that someone could call him a saint, to call back to the title. And then my second to last question was, where are the stakes? Because throughout this film, there wasn't any sort of movement. There were a lot of characters. There were a lot of callbacks. There was some conflict that was set up, but then like never really came to the climactic head that I thought it was going to. And so by the end of it, I felt as though, you know, while David Chase has talked about how movies are his first love and how he wanted The Sopranos to be, at first wanted it to be a film, he was hoping HBO would turn them down so he could make it into a movie. Now he's made a movie that should have, like, seems like he's obviously trying to make it into a series of some sort, because it feels very episodic and underbaked and ends very abruptly in a way that, like, a limited series episode might end. So this movie did not work for me, and there were a lot of moments where it felt like there were unintentionally humorous moments, and then I guess some more humorous moments that were intentional but felt like they shouldn't have been, especially when it comes to violence and the way that plays out. So why? That's my final question. Why? Why?
Didn't work for Aisha. Glenn, how about you?
Well, with any prequel or sequel, we always ask, you know, was this necessary? Does it justify its existence? Is it in any way revelatory? But for this specific thing, I don't know if that was my personal bar. I wouldn't say I was clamoring for it, but after doing all that prep work for yesterday's episode, you know, dipping my toe back into this world, or I guess I have to say, wetting my beak a little bit back in this world, I was curious, and I did enjoy it. It is muddled as hell. The story it's telling isn't a lean or linear one in any sense. And it feels like what David Chase and Lawrence Connor did was they kind of got back to this universe. It's kind of like an old, well-worn shoe. And as soon as they slip their foot in, instead of walking around as you would, they kind of wiggle their toes a bit. So there's a lot of character beats here, a lot of toe wiggling. but not really a lot of propulsive storytelling. But I don't necessarily begrudge it that because, I mean, Chase was interviewed on WTF with Marc Maron recently, and he was very candid about how much this film changed in the editing room, how extensive his reshoots were, how audience testing of earlier cuts of the film suggested that a lot of people were confused because they kept trying to connect the dots. You know, who is this character on screen supposed to be in relation to the show? Now, I don't think all the editing they did minimized that in any way, because I still spent a lot of my time thinking, how much did we see of Tony's father on the show? And did we get to know Dickie at all? I was working overtime on that while I was watching the movie. So there's a lot of shagginess here. Storylines, as Aisha mentioned, that don't pull the weight they're intended to because they feel like add-ons. I got the sense, for example, that there has to have been a much stronger narrative arc for Corey Stoll's Junior Soprano somewhere on the editing room floor right now, because there is a huge payoff to that storyline without a lot of investment in it, if that makes any sense. But one of the things I like best about it is how this film uses Ray Liotta. Without spoiling him, I will say it uses him in a very familiar way, and then it uses him in a very unusual and, I think, clever and smart way that it was my favorite thing about the movie. So that's kind of where I came down.
Alan, you have probably spent more time thinking about The Sopranos than almost anybody that I know. You also have done a bunch of work for Rolling Stone, you know, doing a story about this movie along with a bunch of profiles and interviews about this movie. You know, you've been deep, deep in the world of both the show and the film. Where did you come down on how the film struck you?
I think the movie is really good. I don't think it's great. And I think one of the reasons why is something that Glenn alluded to and that Chase talked about with me for my reporting for Rolling Stone, which is he was really adamant, like he wanted this to be a movie. And in his mind, a movie is a thing that is 2 hours or less. And so he cut a lot of stuff out of it. And you can feel the absence of a lot of connective tissue and a lot of material. And with some of the returning characters, even if they're played by new actors like Tony or Olivia or Junior, you can sort of fill in the blanks yourselves because you know a lot about them. So, for instance, with the Junior thing that Glenn was alluding to me, that really fit into a lot of what we knew about him on the show. And with Tony and his relationship with his mother, especially. With Dickie, with Harold, the Leslie Odom character, with a number of others, they're kind of brand new and they're sort of driving a lot of the story and the movie's skipping around a lot. And so it feels shaggy. It feels like there's a 2.5 or 3 hour version of this that I think would be really fantastic. But even this one, as sort of rough and odd as it is at times, I really just enjoyed being immersed back in the world. I think a lot of the performances are fantastic. I agree with Glenn that Liotta, especially in some of the later scenes, is as good as I've ever seen him. Michael Gandolfini and Vera Farmiga as young Tony and younger Livia are just extraordinary to me. I would have watched a million hours of them playing those characters. It's not quite what I would have necessarily hoped for, but I was still really, really satisfied with it.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the questions that people often have coming into a film like this is, if I wasn't deeply invested in the show, The Sopranos, do I have a chance of finding this satisfying? And to that, I would say no. I mean, look, there's going to be some percentage of people who are going to say, I saw it, I stumbled over it, I gave it a chance, I liked XYZ about it, especially because it's streaming. This film for me was a really interesting opportunity to think through the difference between this is not to my taste and I don't think this is very well done, which is something that we've talked about on this show a lot of times, because I never have had the feeling when watching The Sopranos, I don't think they did a good job making this, right? This film, I had moments where I was like, I just don't think this is very good. And that was both because of some of the structural stuff that you guys have talked about. I think you're not going to care about the payoff of this movie. It's going to seem like it comes out of nowhere unless you are deeply entrenched, I think, in Sopranos lore. But also, there just are parts of this where the effort to re-enter this world was very cartoony to me.
Yeah.
I agree that a lot of the stuff with Livia, although I don't know that it matches up with the Nancy Marchand Livia that I knew very well, it's an interesting performance to me. I get what they're doing. But there is some stuff, particularly with the people who become Tony's kind of associates when they're older, Silvio and Big Pussy and all that stuff, that I think is SNL sketch level of not of sort of clumsy and silly. There's a moment where John Bernthal, an actor I really like, comes into a room and kind of says, the only thing I want to do is bang my Gumar and go to bed. And it feels to me like Who wrote, I know that this was written by members of the same staff. And so that kept taking me out of it a bunch of different times. And I also have to say, and I'm really curious what you guys think about this, I am a big fan of Leslie Odom Jr. I was not a big fan of that story. I think there's an effort, obviously, to recognize the uprisings that were taking place in Newark at the time, the, you know, what they would have called the race riots. And I think it's interesting to get into that, right? It's an interesting idea to try to wrestle with that. But telling that story from the point of view of the Sopranos world and getting very brutal sometimes with the scenes between the various members of these groups, I felt like this movie was out of its area of expertise trying to tell a story about race. And I'm very curious what you guys thought about that.
I think the Leslie Odom character suffers maybe the most of anybody out of a lot of the shorthand that the movie has to use. Like, there's a point in the movie where he just kind of vanishes altogether. And it's very odd because it does seem like they're building towards something. And even for a series that often did anti-climaxes, it structurally feels odd to me. I think that they do some good stuff in the first half in depicting how this guy, sort of his consciousness is raised a little bit to recognize where he sits in this hierarchy and how he really needs to break away from the mob and try to do his own thing, even if the thing he's doing is still violent crime. But no, they don't ultimately service him as well as they could. But it's still a step up from how the show tended to write black characters to begin with, which was not always great.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I just kept coming back to the fact that these types of conflicts between Italian Americans and black Americans have been done so many times, and I think in a lot of places better and more interestingly, a lot of those times through Spike Lee's movies, whether it's Do the Right Thing or Summer of Sam. I don't know. I struggle with the sort of sameness of the things that are happening, and even the way in which Leslie Odom Jr.'s character comes to realize his place, as Alan said. It just felt, I've seen this so many times. Like, I could tell this was where it was going because of the year it was set and because of the tone that was set and the fact that this is set against the backdrop of the Newark uprisings. It was another thing that felt undercooked. And I think, you know, when it comes to The Sopranos, if you want to be undercooked about certain things, that is what it is. But when it comes to something like this and race and having someone as excellent as Leslie Odom Jr. suffer and not really have the meaty role that he should have, that to me is like especially disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, most of this film was shot before George Floyd, and that doesn't excuse it, of course, because it's certainly been sitting on the shelf a long time. It's been edited and re-edited. It seems to me like it was edited and re-edited not to highlight the Leslie Odom Jr. character, but to go back and really drill down on Dickie Malasanto's story. But only one aspect of his story really gets a lot of play here, which is that one with his Gumar, his mistress. And that's fine. But to your point, Aisha, that also is very familiar. Like, we've seen that dynamic play out again and again and again.
I mean, Goodfellas. What?
I would also argue it's not fine. Yeah. My other big issue with this movie is the portrayals of women. And I think, you know, one of the things about The Sopranos is that, again, I could understand the complexity of characters like Carmela, Janice, Livia. You had women in that show who were complicated, who were fully formed. This spends so much time on this character of Giuseppina, who is Dickie's girlfriend. And she, to me, is such a completely unrealized, undeveloped. And when you see ultimately what she's doing in this story and why she's there, it is just so disappointing to me. I do like the Michael Gandolfini performance, not just because he resembles his dad, even though he resembles his dad. I like the way that he's trying to lean into this idea that Tony is mostly not really interested in being a mob guy at that time, like is trying to kind of see if he can figure out how to avoid that outcome for himself. Some of the playing of that story I like, but a lot of this, I couldn't get by. Some of those real cartoony parts really kept hanging me up.
In defense of the cartooniness, it's not like Steve Van Zandt was Olivier
right.
There. There's some incredibly broad performances on The Sopranos, and I think some of those sidekicks here in the movie are very much in keeping with that.
But think about all the stuff that got short shrift so that we could double down on this relationship between Dickie and Tony. And certainly the marketing thinks there's a lot more there than there is there. Like, the, as you mentioned, Aisha, this whole thing is, this is who made Tony Soprano, which suggests in that storyline that there's supposed to be some sense of inevitability, a kind of a runaway train quality pushing Tony into this life. But I'm going to be very careful here. There is a big disconnect between the last few scenes between Tony and Dickie, a sense that things could go in a few different directions, and the film's final image, which it seems like the movie is pushing all its chips in on that and saying, see, sealing the deal. And it's just not enough for me. It just doesn't sell the transition that it needs to sell.
Yeah. I do think, had this been a limited series, there could have been more room for us to see that dynamic play out more, because I feel like, again, that was another thing for me that felt very undercooked, or at least felt very obvious, their dynamic and the way in which Dickie was, like, he held a place in Tony's life that his own father, Tony's own father, did not hold. And that's clear from the series as well. But, like, by the time we get to that ending, I was just like, is that all that there is? Like, really? I mean, I do wonder if they had focused more on Dickie and left Tony mostly out of it. And I think that would have been more interesting.
Well, I mean, the movie kind of runs into this challenge, which is, I mean, I think Alessandro Nivola is very good as Dickie, mm-hmm. but Dickie is just not as compelling a character as Tony. And when Michael Gandolfini walks onto the screen in the second half of the movie, that's kind of all I wanted to see at that point. He's really, really good above and beyond the physical resemblance he has to his dad. And so you have this kind of push-pull in those later scenes between, we have to pay off the Dickie story and we have to resolve it because the movie is a Dickie Moltisanti movie. Like, Moltisanti is Italian for many saints. It's all his story. And then you can sort of feel the filmmakers realizing, hey, wait a minute, like, look what Michael's giving us. We have to start leaning in towards that. They needed to sort of figure out the balance better or build out Dickie a little bit more to justify some of this, even though I did ultimately wind up enjoying the movie, I think, more than anybody else on the panel did.
I want to ask you one more thing before we go, Alan, which is this. Do you think that we are headed for a Soprano extended cinematic universe?
Well, when I talked to all the actors for the features I did for Rolling Stone, most of them seemed on board with that. And David Chase, when I asked him, he at first seemed kind of agnostic, and it seems like he's been pushed forward a little bit more and a little bit more. And I think ultimately it's going to depend on how this movie is received. The fact that it's another one of these day and date things that's in theaters and on HBO Max is probably going to muddy the waters, because this was an HBO show to begin with. And I can see a lot of people, even COVID aside, saying, I'm going to watch this at home because that's how I watch The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what kind of response the movie is going to need to get to lead to more, but I certainly would not be shocked if there was more with some members of this cast.
All right. Well, Alan, I'm delighted that you once again are at the center of the cultural conversation as the man yes! who is obsessed with The Sopranos.
It keeps paying off.
Again, Alan's book is called The Soprano Sessions. I do recommend to you all of the work that he's done about this film at Rolling Stone. And we want to know, obviously, what you think about the movie. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Next up, it's going to be talking to talk about what's making us happy this week.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision, kind of like choosing to listen to your favorite song on repeat. And with their top-rated app, you can deposit checks and transfer money anytime, anywhere, making Capital One an even easier decision. That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
All right. In our What's Making Us Happy This Week segment, we do our very favorite thing this week, every week, all week. All right, Aisha, tell me what's making you happy this week.
Will Smith is a figure, movie star, who I have long been very, very fascinated by. Whether it's The Fresh Prince, he was one of my earliest childhood crushes. I've followed his career, and I've been confused many times about his choices, especially in the last few years. And I really, really dug this profile that Wesley Lowery just did in GQ. This profile really gets into some interesting aspects of the Will Smith persona and the way in which he's kind of been using this persona as someone who is super ambitious. He always wanted to be Mr. 4th of July. He wanted to be the biggest movie star in the world, and how he was always very affable and saying all these sort of platitudes about happiness and Oprah-like things, and how a lot of that belies a darker part of Will Smith. And if you've watched season 2 of Ted Lasso, it kind of feels like the Ted Lasso reveal in a way. And so I highly recommend, if you are at all interested in Will Smith as a person, check out this profile. It's probably one of the more revealing ones that he's ever done in his entire career. And that's a profile in GQ by Wesley Lowry.
All right. Thank you very much, Aisha Harris. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, a listener recommended a Netflix show to me. It's called Jack Whitehall Travels with My Father. Jack Whitehall is a young British actor and comedian. His father is a fuddy-duddy, the fuddiest of all possible duddies. He's a very set in his ways, old white guy in his 70s, a guy who disdains new experiences, who idolizes Winston Churchill, who wears a suit and a hat everywhere. He's the kind of guy you can picture in one of those London men's clubs in a big upholstered chair, smoking a cigar and getting flummoxed by the papers, you know. Ladies in trousers, pon my word. He's a very pon my word kind of guy. So they travel together and they bond because they don't really know each other at all. So the gimmick of the show is Jack wants authentic experiences and the dad wants gin and tonics and finger sandwiches on the veranda at the Ritz. A couple caveats here. It's a little overproduced in the sense that they are clearly doing bits to kind of delineate their different worldviews. So there is always an artifice to the show that never drops as much as you would hope it would. The other thing is, this is a hot take, but skip the first season. That's the season they go to Vietnam, Thailand, and Cambodia. There's a lot of the dad being really openly suspicious and even disdainful, disrespectful of the culture, which is something the show finds a hell of a lot funnier than I do. So it gets much better in the four other seasons where they travel to Europe, the US, Australia, and finally the UK. There's something about an old British guy performatively sneering at Americans, Germans, Aussies, and Brits that hits different than it does in that first season, which kind of left a bad taste in my mouth. So you will come to feel for these two men and for their relationships. So with a couple big caveats, I recommend Jack Whitehall Travels with My Father on Netflix.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Alan Zeppenwall, always happy to hear. What's making you happy this week?
So over the weekend, I devoured a book by the great novelist Megan Abbott called The Turnout. Hard-boiled crime fiction is this really stereotypically male area of interest. And what I love about Abbott's books is she's made this great niche for herself where she applies the tone and style of film noir to stereotypically feminine areas of interest. So she's done past novels about cheerleading and gymnastics, among others. In The Turnout, it's about a pair of sisters who run a ballet school together. They're getting ready for their big annual performance of The Nutcracker. There's a lot of tension among all the girls who want to play the lead role, including some really just awful hazing that goes on. But then there's a fire, and a shady contractor comes in to try to repair the damage of the fire, and basically their lives start to implode as a result of this man's entrance into their lives. And there's a lot of great parallels thematically between the story of the book and the story of The Nutcracker. So it's intertwining all of these things, and Abbott does such a good job of detailing the physical hardships of dance and of creating this really unnerving atmosphere that left me feeling like I needed to take a bath every time I put the book down. I always love her stuff, and The Turnout is no exception.
Thank you very much, Alan Zeppenwall. So what is making me happy this week is part of the New York Times cooking YouTube channel, and it is a series with Sola L. Whaley. She and her husband, whose name is Ham, who is also chef, and they used to have a restaurant together, are doing a series for NYT Cooking called Mystery Menu. And what happens is they are given in a paper bag a mystery ingredient, and they are told you have to make dinner and dessert out of, you know, using this mystery ingredient. So it's kind of got a Chopped feel or a, you know, cooking challenge feel. But of course, with super sophisticated and smart chefs who are very, very personable and work super well together. Usually they try to make some kind of salad and some kind of main and some kind of dessert that features this ingredient. And I love how much they like each other, how warm it is, and also how creative they are. There's one where it's peanut butter, and you know, they get a little bit into it and they start to say, well, maybe one of these things could be peanut butter and jelly. And then they decide that the whole meal should be peanut butter and jelly. So then they try to figure out how can every element of this thing be a take on peanut butter and jelly. Anyway, There are only like a handful of episodes right now because they've been kind of evolving the format a little bit. I highly recommend it. You can find it on YouTube at the MIT Cooking channel, which I am subscribed to. And that is what is making me happy this week. If you want links for what we recommended, plus some additional recommendations, you can subscribe to our newsletter. That's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find Aisha at Crafting My Style. And you can find Alan at Seppenwall. You can follow our editor, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, our producer, Candace Lim, at The Candace Lim, our producer, Jared Gare, at Jared M. Gare, and our producer, Mike Katziff, as always, is at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are enjoying right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Linda.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. We will see you all next week when we will be talking about Star Wars Visions.